beating the waves, swallowing the sky, probably thundering down on a sailboat and crew that were trying to reach the shore. He wondered if flying fish could lift above the waves during a storm of such magnitude. He wished a whirlpool would form around him and this house and Emmeline and suck them under the sea. He hefted up the carbine he had propped by the front door and walked back into the kitchen and fired until the bolt locked open on an empty magazine, the brass dancing like little soldiers on the hardwood floor. Chapter 38. When Helen and I arrived at the crime scene, the rain was driving hard on the bay, turning it into mist, sweeping in sheets across the roof of the house and deck. The 911 call came from a neighbor named Vidrine, who said the daughter of his maid had told him about a man carrying a rifle. The neighbor had gone to the Nightingale camp and discovered the bodies. A fireman in a yellow raincoat with a hood met us at the door. He looked like a bewhiskered monk staring out of a cave. Behind us, I could see the headlights and flashers of several emergency vehicles streaming through the rain. "The dead guy's by the couch," the fireman said. "One bullet wound through the back and out the chest. What looks like a double-edged puncture through the throat." "Where's the woman?" Helen said. "In the kitchen," the fireman said. "Nothing's been touched or moved." "Good job," she said. She went into the kitchen and came back out. "Emmeline Nightingale," she said. "What a mess." "That's the chauffeur on the floor," I said. "His name is Swede Jensen. Cleek got him a job as an extra in Levon's movie."
"Wrong place, wrong time."
I nodded toward the bedroom. Looks like they were getting it on. I went to the kitchen door. I had latex on, so did Helen. There was no brass on the floor, or counters, or table. It was impossible to count the number of wounds. Emmeline's expression was one I had seen before. It was devoid of emotion. The eyes were fixed on nothing. The heart-bursting level of fear and pain. The violent theft of life and soul. The desperate plea that never left the throat would remain unrecorded, written on the wind, in the memory of no one except the killer. Helen flipped open her phone and called the dispatcher. "Find Jimmy Nightingale and tell him to call me immediately. Tell his people nothing, and don't take no from any of them. Out." She looked at me.
"I'll take care of things here. Go up to the Vidrine place and talk to the little girl who saw the man with the rifle."
"Got it," I said.
"How do you figure this?"
"I don't get it at all."
"In what way?" she said.
"If the shooter is Smiley, I don't see the motivation."
"Sex," she said. "When somebody does a number like that on a woman, it's sex."
I drove to the camp up the road where the little girl was waiting for me with her mother on a screened-in gallery. Their clothes were damp from the mist blowing through the screen.
"Can we go inside?" I said.
"Yes, sir. We just didn't want to miss you,"
the mother said. She was overweight and wore a dress and a man's shirt with cut-off sleeves. We went inside the small living room. The owners were gone.
"What happened to your employer?" I asked.
"Mr. Vidrine was upset," the woman replied. "He said this ain't supposed to be happening down here."
I asked the little girl her name, then asked her to describe the man who carried a gun.
"His mouth was real red," she said. "His name was Smiley."
"What did his rifle look like?"
"It had a telescope on top and a can on the front."
"What did he say to you?"
"He told me the story of where flying fish come from. Sharks was always chasing and eating them. Then a magic lady under the sea gave them wings so they could pop out of the waves and fly away."
"That's a pretty good story," I said.
"It wasn't him killed them people, huh?" she said.
"We're not sure, Loretta.
Did Smiley tell you where he was going or where he lives?"
"No, sir."
"What kind of car did he have?"
"It was blue."
I asked about the license and the model, but these were not the kinds of things a child her age would take note of.
Maybe the man in the car that passed him might know, she said.
Which man? What car?
It was purple, she said. What do you call them kind? The top is like canvas.
A convertible.
I seen Smiley drive up the road in his little blue car. The convertible drove down to the point. Then the convertible come back up the road, and I didn't see it no more.
Think hard, Loretta. What did the man in the convertible look like?
I couldn't see good. It was raining, she replied. He was big and had on a little hat.
I stared at the mist and fog rolling off the bay, the bolts of lightning that flickered like snakes' tongues in the clouds. What in God's name are you doing, Cleet? I thought.
Can we go, sir? The mother said. I got to go home and fix supper.
Yes, y'all have been very helpful. Thank you, I said. The girl looked up at me.
I don't think Smiley would hurt anyone, would he, sir?
I didn't answer and instead said good night and drove back to the crime scene. The paramedics were trundling the bodies on gurneys to an ambulance. Inside the house, Helen was talking on her cell phone to Jimmy Nightingale. Her face looked old when she hung up. Bad, I said. He cried. I can never read that guy.
The little girl told me a big guy wearing a small hat and driving a purple convertible passed Smiley on the road.
Smiley was headed north. The convertible was headed south.
Cleet, she said.
Sounds like it. You get his butt in my office at 0800 tomorrow. I left 3 messages for him that night and 1 the next morning. I went by his office. His secretary said she thought he was in New Orleans. When will he be back? I said.
It's Friday, Mr. Dave, in New Orleans. He'll be back when he gets back.
The double murder was the headline story in the Daily Iberian. I felt caught in a situation that was endless and had no good ending. The rain was unrelenting. We had gone from drought that had left the swampland strung with dead vegetation to flooded fields and ditches and front yards and cemeteries in which caskets floated from the crypts. Levon Broussard was transferred to the jail in Jennings, then granted bail a second time. From all accounts, Jimmy Nightingale was devastated. I feared for Cleet, because I believed he was becoming not only obsessed but irrational. I went to a noon meeting, and passed when it was my turn to speak, primarily because I genuinely believed, as Cleet and Helen did, that a shapeless and malevolent entity was in our midst. It was not the kind of stuff that improved a recovering drunk's day. At 1:30 p.m. Saturday, Cleet called me at home. "Where are you?" I asked.
"In the Big Sleazy. Where else? If you're worried about Homer, he's with the lady I hire."
"You were seen at the Nightingale's camp, Cleet. Shortly after Smiley did a job on Swede Jensen and Emmeline Nightingale."
"So what?"
"What were you doing there?"
"I wanted to have another run at Jimmy Nightingale. The St. Mary deputy told me he was probably at the camp."
"You could end up a suspect."
"I was trying to be courteous and return your calls, big man. How about getting off my case?"
"Don't shine me on."
"I'm going to bring that lying cocksucker down," he said. "Maybe I won't bust a cap on him, but one way or another I'm going to put a freight train up his ass. I mean that literally, in the bridal suite in Angola."
"How are you going to do that?"
"Nail him as a co-conspirator in the death of the Jeff Davis 8. One way or another, I'm going to get him. I've had a good life."
Then I remembered Jimmy Nightingale had a rally that night at the Superdome. "I'll put you in handcuffs if I have to," I said. He was already off the line. I headed for New Orleans in my pickup, the rain twisting out of a gaseous green sky. Just as I approached the bridge at Des Allemands, my cell phone vibrated on the seat. It was Sherry Picard.
"Cleet left me a message," she said. "Something about him being sorry for his part in it. And if he didn't see me again, I was a great woman, blah, blah, blah."
"Cleet isn't into blah, blah, blah."
"Whatever. He sounded like he was on a bonsai mission."
"He says he's going to take down Jimmy Nightingale," I said, "in whatever fashion he can. Nightingale has a rally at the Superdome tonight.
Shit, she said. Cleet's talking about capping him?
I didn't say that. I was atop the bridge now. I could see houseboats anchored at a wooded island, the bayou flowing into a chain of lakes, the rain denting the water. Somehow I knew what was coming, and I didn't want to hear it.
Here's the gin, she said. Remember the fast food trash by Kevin Penny's motorcycle shed? I matched the prints. They belong to Rowena Broussard.
I thought she wasn't in the system.
She visited her husband when he was temporarily locked up. I gave her a cup of coffee in a styrofoam cup.
The match might put her at the scene, but not at the time of Penny's death.
It gets worse, at least from a prosecutor's perspective. The prints of Herb Smith, a social worker, were at the scene.
I don't remember the name, I said.
It doesn't matter. His niece was one of the Jeff Davis Eight. Starting to get the picture?
You think Rowena did it, but there's no way she'll be convicted?
That's right.
Then Levon won't either, because people around here think he walks on water?
You got it.
What does this have to do with Cleet? I asked.
He's convinced himself Jimmy Nightingale is partly responsible for the Jeff Davis Eight, and for Penny's death, and for the attempt to put a bomb in his car. I don't think Nightingale has anything to do with any of it.
I wouldn't rule Nightingale out, Miss Sherry. At least not entirely.
Lose the Gone with the Wind stuff, will you? I can't take that plantation cutesy talk.
You know who else told me that? I asked.
No.
Rowena Broussard, I said.
See you at the dome, hotshot.
For 5 days in August 2005, the Superdome had been shelter for more than 30,000 people during and after Hurricane Katrina. Do not let the term shelter mislead you. The dome became an introduction to hell on earth. The storm stripped off huge chunks of the roof. The power and water supply failed. Toilets and urinals overflowed and layered the floors with feces. The food in the refrigerators rotted. The heat and humidity and stench caused television reporters to gag on camera. Every inch of concrete surrounding the dome was covered with garbage, clothing, and people sweltering under a white sun. Black people who tried to leave the area by crossing the Danziger Bridge were shot by police officers. One of those who died was a mentally disabled man. But our excursion into the Garden of Gethsemane had slipped into history. The incompetence and cynicism and villainy of its perpetrators largely unpunished. The bravery and self-sacrifice of its heroes, such as the United States Coast Guard, largely unremembered. Jimmy's rally was more like Mardi Gras than a political event, even though most of the crowd knew about the murder of his sister. The purple and green columns of light surrounding the dome were an ode to the ancient world, a pagan display presided over by a rotund and garlanded and sybaritic man who understood his constituency's love of shared power and empire and blood sports and the opportunity to participate and glory in them. I called Cleet and went directly to voicemail. Dixieland bands played outside and inside the dome. The musicians in candy-striped jackets and straw boaters, their smiles frozen like ceramic dolls. Tens of thousands filled the seats and aisles and corridors. The concession stands were heaped with Cajun and Creole cuisine. Draft beer was $10 a cup, and a double-shot cocktail was $14.50. Jimmy Nightingale t-shirts and caps were everywhere. The ammonia smell of urinated beer bloomed from the men's rooms. By the time Jimmy mounted the stage, the crowd had doubled, and the air was filled with an electric haze and a growing feral odor from the press of bodies in the corridors and aisles. Jimmy was dressed in mourner's black, but through the tiny binoculars I carried, I could see a flag pin on his lapel and sequins that had been sprayed on his hand-tooled boots and his gold cufflinks that were the size of quarters. His incarnations were endless, like Proteus rising from the sea. In this instance, he vulgarized his own image and yet did it with elegance.
His short-brimmed Stetson, one he never wore in Franklin, hung from his hand. His expression was neither somber nor celebratory. He gazed silently at the crowd, bathed in light, his posture and trim physique and resolute manner heartbreaking, considering the loss he had just incurred. All sound and motion in the dome seemed to slow like a film winding down, then stop. Even the beer vendors in the aisles were motionless, their box-like trays suspended painfully from their necks.
"I want to thank you," Jimmy said, a tremble in his voice. "I cannot express how much I appreciate your being here. You are the finest people I have ever known. God bless each and every one of you."
The stage lights were pointed up into his face, giving it the angular splendor of a Byzantine saint. One by one, the audience members came to their feet, applauding lightly at first, then breaking into an ovation that shook the building. Tears slid down both his cheeks. Then Jimmy did something I never saw coming. He went to the back of the platform and motioned for a man to join him. Even the audience seemed stunned. A gaunt figure whose plastic surgery had failed him was being raised from the dead, a modern Lazarus dragged against his will into the light, all his sins forgiven. Even he did not seem to understand his good fortune. He raised one hand timidly, as though afraid of the response. The audience was transfixed and did not know what to do. Jimmy lifted a microphone from a stand.
"Many of us take different roads in our struggle to keep our country free and pure and unsullied by the millions crossing our borders. Bobby Earl loves his country and the traditions for which our brave fighting men and women have shed their blood. We help the poor, the immigrant who honors our laws, the destitute and downtrodden, but we do not let others rob us of our heritage and birthright. Bobby Earl devoted his life to an honorable cause, and we will not be party to the political correctness that condemns a man because he speaks his mind and practices the freedoms guaranteed him by the First Amendment. Bobby is a good man, a Christian, and a patriot. Let's give him the credit he deserves, and to hell with the people who don't like it. I'm proud to call Bobby Earl my friend."
One heartbeat later, someone let loose with a rebel yell, and the entire place went crazy. That was when I saw Cleet Purcell standing in a doorway that led to the concourse. He was eating a hot dog, wiping his mouth with a paper napkin as he chewed. My cell phone vibrated in my pocket. I looked at the caller ID and put the phone to my ear. "This is Dave."
"I'm in the dome," Sherry Picard said. "Have you found Cleet?"
"I just saw him. He went into the concourse. I'm walking there now. Before you hang up, I have to ask you a question."
"Go ahead."
"How does a woman the size of Rowena Broussard take down a guy like Penny?"
"Succinylcholine."
"Say again?"
"It paralyzes the muscles. Somebody shot a hypodermic load of it into his system. Rowena was a nurse in South America, wasn't she? Those lefties are a howl.
Cleet fought for the leftists in El Sal.
I gave him a dispensation."
"Stay away from this person," I thought. Chapter 39. Cleet left the concourse and worked his way to the other side of the dome, hoping to come up on the backside of the stage. If he could make it that far, he was going to walk onto the stage. It was undignified, self-abasing, and maybe the act of a public fool. What did it matter? He thought of the graves he had dug with an E-tool, the bodies hung in trees after the VC got finished with them, the people who had sat on scalding rooftops in the lower Ninth Ward, waiting for the helicopters. This was the kind of world Cleet believed Jimmy Nightingale would preside over. The man used people as he would a suppository. Cleet wanted to print him on a wall. But this was fantasy, and he knew it. As a boy, Cleet had never been a bully, although older and bigger boys had bullied him. He even forgave the kid from the Iberville Project who bashed him with the pipe that left the scars through his eyebrow. The kid had grown up no differently than Cleet,
and later died at Khe Sanh. For Cleet, the myth of Wyatt Earp was not a myth. You smoked them when they dealt the play, but not before, even if you had to eat a bullet. And for that reason alone, Cleet would always be at a disadvantage in dealing with a cunning man like Nightingale, who minutes earlier had incorporated the racism of Bobby Earle into his campaign while acting as the bestower of forgiveness. Cleet passed a restroom and a locked office, then found a door that opened onto a storage area under the stands. He opened a second door onto an entryway from which he could see the backside of Nightingale as he introduced a famous country singer wearing a thick felt, tall-crowned white cowboy hat and a pale blue western-cut suit stitched with flowers. Cleet also saw a beer vendor whose pants and shirt looked dipped in starch, the trousers stuffed inside rubber boots, a Nightingale baseball cap sitting on his eyebrows. He was a short, pudgy man with lips like red licorice. Cleet stared at the vendor, but didn't move. What was he waiting for? He started again toward the aisle, his gaze riveted on the vendor's neck. "Let it play out," a voice said. His stomach was churning. Maybe he's just an ordinary guy, he thought. What if you start something, and security gets the wrong idea and the guy gets hurt just so Nightingale is safe? But he knew the real reason for his unwillingness to act. The weight on his heart was the size of an anvil. "What are you doing here, asshole?" a voice said. Cleet turned around. Once again, he was looking into the face that was one of many he could never rid himself of. The faces were out of a subculture that fed on need and dysfunction and systemic cruelty. In this case, the face of an old-time gun bull, whose measure of self-worth was the degree to which he could inspire terror in others. He wore tight gray slacks with high pockets, and a shirt the color of tin, and a bolo tie, and a salt-and-pepper mustache as stiff as wire, and a belt equipped with mace, handcuffs, a slapjack, and a blue-black semi-auto with checkered grips. "Burl Wooster is the full name, isn't it?" Cleet said. "When I woke up, it was. Answer my question. I just saw a beer vendor who might be the guy called Smiley." "You talking about this guy out of Florida?" "He's down there."
"Where?"
Cleet turned around and looked down the aisle.
"I don't see him now."
"Because he was never there."
"A guy who fits his description was there."
"And you're a goddamn liar."
Cleet's eyes searched the crowd again.
"I think we blew an opportunity, but maybe not."
"You know why I don't like you, Purcell? One guy like you taints a whole department. It's like trying to launder the stink out of shit."
"You screwed the pooch, dickhead. By the way, that black kid you killed on the levee, he was 19.
"Until he stopped being 19, Wooster said. "I lost a lot of sleep over that."
"How's it feel?" Cleet said.
"How's what feel?"
Cleet shook his head.
"Don't pay attention to me."
Wooster removed a toothpick from his shirt pocket and put it into his mouth.
"I'm going to dial you up one of these days, Purcell."
The crowd began to drain from the dome.
"I hear there's a reception at the casino," Cleet said.
"Not for you, Raisin."
"See you around, Wooster. Don't beat up on any handicapped people."
Wooster elevated the toothpick with his teeth, his eyes veiled. I found Sherry Picard in the concourse and called Cleet again. This time he answered.
"Where are you?" I asked.
"Behind the stage," he said. "I just got braced by an ex-gun bull from Angola. He blew away a black inmate for sassing him and put a shank on his body, a guy named Wooster."
"Who?"
"He does security for Nightingale."
"What does Wooster have to do with anything?" I said.
"Nothing. I think I saw Smiley. He's posing as a beer vendor. I was maybe 40 feet from him when Wooster came down on me."
"You let a hump for Nightingale stop you from taking down Smiley?"
"Not exactly."
I couldn't put together what he was saying. Then it hit me.
"You were going to let Smiley get to Nightingale?"
The thought occurred to me.
"I'm with Sherry Picard. Wait for us."
You brought her here?
No, she came on her own.
Butt out on this, Dave. I got a handle on it.
The way you handled Smiley?
You want the truth? He said. I was going to make sure both of them went off the board. Wooster screwed things up.
Stay where you are.
I'm going to the casino. My car is parked 6 blocks away. It'll take me a while to get there.
What's at the casino?
A reception for Nightingale.
I'll drop the dime on you, Cletus.
No, you won't. Keep Sherry out of it. I'm copacetic and very cool and collected and totally in control of the situation. You're the best, Big Mun.
Cleet had to walk to the other side of LaSalle to retrieve his caddy. The sky was still dark, the rain blowing off the roofs of the few lighted buildings along the street. He cut through an alley lined with banana plants and garbage cans that had been knocked over by the wind. Twice he thought he heard footsteps behind him, but when he turned around, no one was there. The second time he stepped between two buildings and waited. An elderly black man on a bicycle pedaled down the sidewalk at the end of the alley. Cleet continued on. He walked past a collapsed garage to the back of a deserted brick house where he had parked his vehicle. A tall man in a slicker and a wilted rain hat was standing by the driver's door. His face was dark with shadow. His shoulders were rectangular, his coat open, his hands invisible.
Beat you to it. You'd make a good bird dog, Cleet said. Nice wheels, the tall man said.
Am I going to have trouble with you? Cleet said.
You hold grudges, Purcell. That nigger I popped had a shiv on him.
After you planted it.
You killed a federal witness.
It was an accident.
That's why you hid out in El Salvador. A lot of people go down there when they do something by accident.
Cleet looked at his watch.
What's your problem, Wooster?
I don't have one. You do. The federal witness you killed was a friend of mine. You got your drop with you.
Why do you want to know?
Maybe I can make use of it.
I'm not carrying.
Doesn't matter. You're in the shitter.
Wooster parted his coat and lifted a semi-auto into the light. He grinned.
We can do it standing up, or you can kneel down.
You're kidding.
I don't like you. I put down 7 people nobody knows about. What do you say to that?
Give your bullshit to somebody else.
Look into the barrel and tell me it's bullshit.
What do you get out of it?
Kicks.
A guy like you does nothing for kicks except maybe standing in line to fuck your mother.
Later tonight after you're dead, I'm going to get laid. Think about that.
Since I'm about to go out, tell me something. Who put the drill to Kevin Penny?
Maybe you're looking at him. Who cares? Bye-bye, asshole.
So this is how it comes, Cleet thought. Not the Jolly Green caving in half when an RPG came through the bay. The frag he took in the carotid. The 2 rounds in the back while carrying his best friend down a fire escape. The burning roof that crashed on him when he ran through the flames with a little girl wrapped in a blanket.
Fuck you, Wooster, he said.
Then he saw a flash at the entrance to the alley across the street, like a downed power line that had dropped onto a car roof, and heard a sound like pit, or someone spitting. Wooster heard and saw it also. He widened his eyes and stared into the darkness, his gun still pointed at Cleet's chest. His jaw was hooked, his profile like a barracuda's. Cleet heard the sound twice again. The first round punched through Wooster's throat. Still holding the gun, he clenched one hand over the wound, blood congealing immediately between his fingers. He made a choking sound, as if he'd swallowed a fish bone. The second round made a hole less than the diameter of a pencil above his eyebrow, as though a bug had settled on it and exited the back of his head cleanly and knocked out a window in a garage. He fell into a greasy pool of water, curled in an embryonic position, the rain falling in his eyes. A cat meowed by a garbage can. The wind gusted, and a strip of tin on the roof of the deserted house swung on a nail. Cleet slid behind the wheel of the caddy and drove around the body into the street, hitting his brights, lighting up the alleyway where the shots had come from. His wipers were beating wildly, the windshield fogging. At the end of the alley, he saw a man in rubber boots running, a rifle cupped in his right hand, his skin as white as a slug's. Cleet picked up his cell phone from the seat and dialed a number with his thumb. Sherry Picard and I were inside the casino when I got his call. The casino was packed, the roar of noise deafening. "I can't hear you, Cleet. You're not making sense."
"I went to get my car," he said. "Wooster, the gun bull, was waiting for me. He was going to kill me. He almost did."
"How would he know where your car was?"
"He was walking behind me, then got ahead of me, and saw the caddy," he replied. "I asked him if he did Kevin Penny. He said maybe. Then Smiley put two bullets in him."
"You're talking about the security guy?"
"Who do you think?"
"He killed Penny?"
"Maybe he was working my crank."
I worked my way into a corner, far from the drink and food tables where most of the crowd was concentrating. Why would Smiley drop one of Nightingale's security people?
"I don't know. It wasn't an accident. The guy is too good a shot."
"Smiley owes you?"
"Most of his victims were abused women or children or connected with people who abused women or children. Smiley tried to put a bomb in my car. He might have killed Homer. So maybe Smiley found out he got set up to kill a child and started cleaning the slate. Where's Nightingale?"
"Forget about Nightingale," I said.
"Like I can."
"Did you call 911 on a shooting?"
"In New Orleans? NOPD would have me on the injection table."
"Where are you now?"
"In a filling station restroom, washing the splatter off me. I'll be there in 15 minutes.
"Drop it, Cleet. Let's go back to New Iberia."
"That's what you're always trying to do, Dave. You don't get it."
"Pardon?"
"The place you remember isn't there," he said. "There are no safe places anymore. Everyone knows that, except you."
No, everyone did not. I had at least one partner in my grand illusion about the relativity of time and the melding together of the past and present and future, and the possibility that the dead are still with us, like the boys in Butternut marching through the flooded cypress at Spanish Lake, and the slaves who beckon us to remove the chains that bind them to the auction block, and all the wandering souls who want to scratch their names on a plaster wall so someone will remember their sacrifice, the struggle that began with the midwife's slap of life and their long day's journey into the grave. I think madness is a matter of definition, but if you are afflicted by it, you thank God for those who share it with you. And that was why I was always drawn to Levon Broussard, and paradoxically to Jimmy Nightingale. Neither accepted the world as it is, and neither was entirely rational. However, their difference lay elsewhere, and in this case, the difference was critical not only to them, but to us. Jimmy was a brilliant man who, of his own volition, chose to model himself on his benighted antecedents, demagogues who need no more mention. Conversely, Levon was the artist who enlisted in lost causes, flagellating himself because he could not change the nature of mankind. After I finished talking to Cleet, my cell phone throbbed again. It was Allifair. "Rowena and Levon Broussard just left our house," she said. "You won't believe this."
"I probably will," I replied.
"Rowena says she tortured and killed Kevin Penny."
"Yep."
"You're not surprised?"
"What do they plan to do now?"
"They didn't say. Rowena wanted to get it off her conscience. After Penny raped her, she thought he might be involved with the murder of the girls in Jeff Davis Parish. She thought she was going to get justice for them, and for herself."
"What did she find out from Penny?"
"Nothing."
"I'm not sure I believe her story. Maybe she's muddying the water so Levon can skate. Maybe neither of them is involved."
"Are you serious?" she said.
"A former hack at Angola named Wooster told Cleet he did it."
Told him when? Tonight, just before Smiley killed him. Smiley just killed someone else? In New Orleans? He gets around. Call Rowena and Levon and tell them what I said. You're trying to queer the DA's case, aren't you? All this would come up in discovery anyway. The former gun bull was going to kill Cleet. Smiley saved his life.
I bet he loves his mother, too, she said.
I doubt it. Talk to you later, Alf. I closed the cell phone.
Chapter 40.
Sherry Picard and I moved deeper into the crowd at the casino. The carpets were the color of a freshly sliced pomegranate. The gaming tables covered with lavender felt. Giant bronze replicas of palm trees looked down on the tables. Each gambling machine was outfitted with a padded, leather-backed chair that gave the patron a sense of comfort and security. The ceilings were high and spacious and created the impression of a separate universe, but one that allowed no view of the outside world. Jimmy Nightingale was at the beverage tables, surrounded by hundreds of well-wishers, his security people around him, but having a hard time of it.
"There's Cleet," Sherry said.
"Where?"
"By the door."
I stood on my toes and tried to see over the heads of the crowd. "I don't see him."
"I'm almost sure it was him. He's gone now."
I pushed my way through the crowd. Many of them were drunk or on the edge of drunk. Over the heads, I could see Bobby Earle with Nightingale. Somebody clamped me on the shoulder.
"Roma Show! You back on the hooch? Son of a bitch, I thought you on the side of the tree huggers. You one of us, you old bastard?"
He was a big, sweaty, red-faced man whose skin oozed grease and whose rumpled suit smelled like a locker room. He threw a meaty arm over me, a well of stink rising from his armpit. I had no idea who he was.
"God damn it, son! It's good to see you! This November we're gonna kick some ass! Who's this lady with you?"
Sherry opened her badge in his face.
"On the job. Beat feet, fatso."
"What was that?"
he said, releasing me.
"What'd you call me?"
She pushed him in the chest.
"You heard me."
"What do you think you're doing?"
he said.
"You can't push people around like that."
I was still 40 feet from Nightingale. I felt like I was sinking in wet concrete.
"Somebody call security," the fat man said. "There's a crazy woman here."
I thought I saw Cleet on the edge of the crowd. I changed direction and headed toward him. I popped out on the back edge of the crowd and saw the men's room door open and smoke billow out. Cleet was nowhere in sight. A short man in a Panama hat and oversized white slacks and two-tone shoes and a dark blue shirt with bananas printed on it, worn outside the belt, was walking from the restroom through the banks of gambling machines and the throng that had come through a side entrance and was headed for the free booze and food.
"Smiley!" I shouted.
He did not turn around or change his stride. I went after him. A band up on a platform broke into the Star-Spangled Banner. When Cleet saw the smoke, he went straight to the restroom and watched the men flowing out the door. A young man in a security guard uniform carrying a fire extinguisher almost knocked him down.
"Sorry, sir," the guard said.
"You see a short guy with skin like an albino?" Cleet said.
"No," the security guard said. "He has something to do with the fire?"
Cleet looked through the doorway. Three waste baskets packed with wet paper towels were burning.
"His name is Smiley. He kills people."
"Sir, is that a weapon under your coat?"
"I'm a PI. I have a license to carry."
"Not in the casino, sir. Not under Louisiana law. That's a fact, sir."
"Take it easy," Cleet said. "We're on the same side."
The security guard began spraying the fire with the extinguisher, glancing at Cleet.
"I got my hands full. You're not supposed to have a firearm in here, sir. I'll have to take it from you."
"How do you fault a brave kid for doing his job?"
"Listen, there's a guy running loose in here who probably killed Jimmy Nightingale's sister. Don't give me a hard time. You digez-vous, nobleman?"
"I don't speak French, sir."
"Look, you're stand up and trying to do your job, but don't let your job get ahead of your brain."
The smoke had gathered on the ceiling, and eye-watering amounts of it were still rising from the cans.
"I have to ask for your gun, sir,"
the security guard said. He was not armed. He put his two-way to his ear.
I'm sorry to do this, Cleve said. He tore the radio from the security guard's hand. He wanted to smash it or throw it into the commode. He looked at the humiliation in the security guard's face. What's your name?
Jody Weinberger.
My name is Cleet Purcell. You got moxie, Jody. Cleet tossed him the two-way. How about you forget my piece and cover my back? Do me a solid, kid. You won't regret it.
I could do that.
The bad guy I told you about is the real deal. His name is Smiley.
What do we do when we find him?
We take him down, Cleet said. But his words tasted bitter and insincere before they left his mouth. Cleet pushed his way through the crowd. Once again, he had thoughts of a kind he'd never had. A sense of foreboding that normally only deranged or messianic people were haunted by. As though only they saw the dark portent of the events taking place around them. In Cleet's mind, Jimmy Nightingale had become the hooded figure that lives in our sleep. A memory passed on from the caves of ancient Albion and the pantheons of Philistines. The embodiment of guile and deception. A serpent cracking through its shell in a garden between the Tigris and the Euphrates. Then Cleet saw him, surrounded by his acolytes, Bobby Earl by his side. The band was playing Under the Double Eagle. Amid the meretricious decor of the casino, Nightingale's face was suffused with the soft, buttery glow of a gold coin. Bobby Earl's hand rested on his shoulder. Cleet had never hated a man as much as Nightingale. He longed for the excuse to free his snub nose from his holster and in a blaze of bullets free the world forever of the creature he was sure the Bible warned us about. He looked over his shoulder. Jody Weinberger was right behind him, his youthful, trusting face expectant, his eyes fixed on Cleet's.
"Shouldn't we warn Mr. Nightingale?"
Jody said. On the far side of a craps table, Cleet saw a man in a Panama hat and a loud shirt, his arms like rolls of sourdough, his head tilted down, his expression concealed.
"Can you answer me, Mr. Purcell?" the security guard said. "Maybe we should call it in. Sir, we've got to do something, or I've got to call for help."
I felt as though I were in a mob of revelers at a public execution. The fat man who had clamped my shoulder was still with us, leading two security guards, pushing people out of his way. "There she is!" he shouted. "Impersonating a police officer! Lock that bitch up!" A woman fell and a man tripped over. The brass horns in the band were ear-splitting. Someone with horrendous breath was yelling incoherently in my face. I had no idea who he was. "What do you want?" I yelled.
"My wife is having a heart attack," he said.
He looked around desperately.
"Help me get her out of here!"
"I'm sorry, I can't help you," I said. Sherry grabbed my arm. "Look, on the other side of the craps table, the guy in the Panama hat. Is that him?" Smiley was standing alone, as though no one was in the building except him and Jimmy Nightingale. I saw him reach into his right-hand pocket. I began fighting my way toward him. It was like swimming with a bag of rocks strapped on my back. Cleet saw Smiley moving toward Jimmy Nightingale and Bobby Earl, a hand in his pocket, a sweet look on his face. Cleet reached inside his coat for his snub nose, but he didn't pull it from its holster. "Is that him, Mr. Purcell?" Jody said. "Is that him? What are you waiting on, sir?" "Let it happen," a voice said. "You're not God."
"You got to, Mr. Purcell,"
Jody said. "Got to do what?" Cleet replied, as though drugged.
"Stop whatever is happening!"
"Get out of here, kid," Cleet said.
"This is my job! I was trying to help you!"
"That man up there is shit. Don't let him ruin your life. Now beat it before I knock you down."
Jody tried to get around him.
Cleet hit him in the chest with an elbow, then saw Smiley ease a small revolver from his pocket and lower it by his thigh and begin walking rapidly toward Nightingale. Cleet burst from the crowd and crashed through Jimmy Nightingale's security people, his gun falling from his holster. He tackled Jimmy and slammed him to the carpet just as Smiley fired one shot, then a second one. Cleet could hear the breath wheeze out of Jimmy's chest and feel the spray of spittle on his cheek. When Jimmy tried to get up, Cleet mashed his head into the carpet with a forearm. The casino turned into bedlam. Everyone around Sherry and me either ran for the exits or cowered on the floor. Sherry squatted behind me, pulling a revolver from an ankle holster, trying to see beyond the beverage table where Cleet and Jimmy Nightingale were. She pushed past me, touching my shoulder to steady herself, her face tight and pale, like that of someone looking into an Arctic wind. I stood up next to her, my 9mm in my hand. "You see him?" I asked. "Who?" she said. "Smiley." "No." "Circle to the left, I'll go right," I said. "Roger that." Then she said, "Oh, fuck." "What do you see?" I said. "That kid. He's got a gun. He looks like he's about to piss his pants." Amid the sea of people on the floor, we saw a young security guard walking toward the drink and food tables. He was pointing a white-handled, snub-nosed revolver, a .38, with both arms extended in front of him. The snub-nose looked exactly like Cleet's. Smiley was somewhere beyond a bronze palm tree and a fountain dancing with red and green and purple lights. Sherry and I closed on him from both sides. He began firing and then shucked his shells and used a speed loader and started firing again. Both of us huddled behind marble pillars and tried to get a clear shot, one that wouldn't hit a civilian. I could hear Smiley's rounds going long, breaking glass and ricocheting off metal and stone. I thought I heard a woman cry out. The kid who had the snub nose was advancing on Smiley, snapping off 3 rounds, heedless of the people in the background. Cleet raised himself on his elbows. He looked up at the young security guard.
"Get down before you kill somebody!"
"I'm going to get him, Mr. Purcell."
"There's a dining room and a kitchen back there!"
Jimmy Nightingale crawled out from under Cleet. He pressed his wrist against his nose and looked at it.
"How much do you weigh?"
"Shut up," Cleet said. One of the food and beverage tables had been knocked over, and the carpet was soaked in booze and etouffee and shrimp and crawfish casserole.
"You saved my life," Jimmy said. "Maybe Bobby's too."
"Shut your fucking mouth, Nightingale. I want to tear you up. You and Earl both. I want to keep you alive and hurt you every day of your worthless life. I don't care how this ends, but wherever you see me, you better cross the street." Jimmy sat up and found a napkin and touched at his bloody nose and wiped off his shirt.
"You're a hell of a guy, Cleet, whether you know it or not."
Cleet fitted his hand on Jimmy's face like a starfish clamping a stone, mashing his nose, and shoved his head as hard as he could, almost snapping his neck. I bolted from behind the marble pillar and dove headlong behind a row of gambling machines. Sherry was running toward Smiley at the same time. The security guard went past me, firing Cleet's revolver. People were flattened on the floor throughout the casino. Then I heard the revolver snap on an empty chamber. Sherry stood up, gripping her 9mm with 2 hands, and fired until the bolt locked open. The lights went out in the concourse that led to the front of the building. Smiley had disappeared.
"Dave!"
I heard Cleet say. I turned around. There was blood on his shirt.
"Are you hit?" I asked.
"Nightingale had a nosebleed and got it on my shirt. I saved that pushead's life. I'll never get over it. Where's Smiley?"
He headed for the exit.
"Where's the security guard? Where's my piece? I'm going to kill that kid!"
A semblance of order began to take place in the casino. My hands were trembling. The young security guard walked toward us. He handed Cleet the snub nose.
"He got away. Some people in the concourse were wounded. Maybe flying glass or something."
I turned in a circle. "You see Sherry?" "A minute ago," Cleet said. "Out of the corner of my eye, she was putting another magazine in her 9mm. Medical personnel were coming through the portals of the building. The bandstand was a wreck. The fat man who'd wanted Sherry arrested was still yelling. The man whose wife had suffered a heart attack was weeping. I saw Sherry sitting in one of the leather-padded gambling machines, her back to me. She seemed to be staring at the 5 golden bells inside the machine's window. Her piece rested on her thigh. I walked through the trash scattered on the floor and touched on her back. "You good, detective?"
"Lost my breath,"
she said. Take my piece. I'm getting over the hill for this shit. Did you get him? Smiley? It doesn't look like it. Too bad, she said. Some fun, huh? Boss. I stepped closer to her and rested my hand on her shoulder. Her head dipped forward. And then I saw the blood welling through her shirt, pooling in her slacks. The light was still in her eyes, like tiny chips of a diamond frozen in time. But there was no movement on her body, except for the second hand on her watch. Epilogue. It's fall now, and the election is over, and Jimmy Nightingale is a member of the United States Senate, probably headed for an even grander career. The assassin nicknamed Smiley disappeared inside Mexico or the Caribbean islands, depending on which law enforcement agency you talk to. For many legal reasons, neither LaVon nor Rowena Broussard ever stood trial for the death of Kevin Penny. But the real reason was that nobody cared. In fact, LaVon and Rowena adopted Homer. I knew the truth about Rowena's culpability, but I joined ranks with those who looked the other way. Perhaps I've become a cynic. Or better said, I've learned to let the season have its way, to not fight against the pull of the earth and the tidal movements of the oceans and the admonitions that the race is not to the swift, and that the earth abides forever. Cleet had saved the life of a man he hated and may have contributed to the ascendancy of a man who would write his name on the clouds in the worst possible way. In the meantime, a brave woman lost her life from a bullet that ballistics proved to have ricocheted from Cleet's snub nose. Although exonerated, the boy who fired the round will probably live with guilt the rest of his life. Whenever Cleet and I are in New Orleans, we ask him to dinner. He never accepts the invitation. I visit Molly's grave, and I try to financially help the widow of T.J. D'Artez. I sleep little, welcome each dawn, and bring Snugs and Monty Coon into the house and feed them no matter how muddy they are. Through the summer, I watched the completion of LaVon's film, and in December, Alifair and I went to see its screening in Los Angeles. I had a strange experience in the theater. To this day, I cannot explain it. The scene was on Beauregard's left flank on a gray spring dawn outside the settlement known as Shiloh Church. The actors wore faded butternut, some with gold or blue piping, and were crouched among hemlock trees, looking up a hill where Yankee artillery was already in place, loaded with grape and chain and canister and exploding shells, the crews de-elevating in anticipation of the Confederate charge. There could be no doubt about the outcome. The commanding Confederate officer, a purple plume in his hat, rode his horse up and down a shallow creek with his sword drawn. "No matter what happens, boys, form on me," he said. "You're men of the South. Be not afraid. God and our people are with you. Drummer, begin your beat." The entire regiment rose to its feet, and a boy not over 12, the one I'd seen splashing his way through the shallows at Spanish Lake, began a ragged cadence that set the regiment in motion like stick figures lurching unsteadily into a wind. Their faces white, their equipment banging, some of them barefoot. Halfway up the hill, the artillery crews at the top of the slope fired in sequence down the line, like a string of giant firecrackers, then reloaded and fired at will. The slaughter was immediate. The slope was blanketed with fog, the air filled with the rebel yell, a fox call that sounded like, "Hoo, hoo, hoo." The green of the hillside and the wildflowers, slick with gore. The aggregate of smoke and dust and river mist seemed filled with bolts of lightning, as though a thunderstorm from heaven had lost its way and descended upon the earth. Inside the smoke, The battle flag of Granny Lee flipped back and forth on a staff, barely visible against the pale sun, its cloth rent with grape shot. The commanding officer was still seated on his horse, his plumed hat on the point of his sword, shouting, "Don't falter, boys! We've got them, by God! Just a little farther! Form on me!" The drummer boy and most of the others died or were wounded in under 10 minutes. Was this magnificent and tragic ordeal, one that could compare to Golgotha, the manufacture of evil men who wanted to keep our brothers and sisters enslaved? I will never believe that. I think of each dawn as a gift, and I try to remember that the horns blowing along the road to Roncesvalles save us from ourselves and the curse of mediocrity. But maybe that's just another way of saying fuck it. You've got me. I never figured out anything.
Robichaux, a novel, was written by James Lee Burke and read by Will Patton. It was recorded by Noriko Okabe and Ryan Lissy at Simon & Schuster in New York. Editing and post-production by Mike Ticino for Common Mode. Terry Hogan was the mix engineer. The associate producer was Elliot Rombach. Robichaux was produced and directed by Christina Zarafanidis. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Robichaux, a novel, is available in print from Simon & Schuster. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio by James Lee Burke, read by Will Patton, Light of the World, a Dave Robichaux novel, and The Jealous Kind, a novel.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.